Welcome. Welcome to the September Citizens Climate Lobby call. My name is Mark Reynolds. I'll be hosting today's call, and I'm a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby staff. I want to particularly thank Leslie Beatty and Nick Huey from our marketing department for that last 2 minutes of video. This is a very difficult time we're all facing, and it's really easy to be angry and upset and afraid. And it's important that they reminded us that our special sauce is love. You know, our way forward is democracy, but our way of expressing that is by loving people. I also want to just say to, you know, Dr. Hansen, our country's leading climate scientist, in the 1980s testified before Congress that we would see a greater frequency and severity of weather-related events, and we're seeing that. And a lot of our staff and volunteers in Louisiana, the Pacific Northwest, are doing things now to be working in their community. They let us know that they'll listen to the recording of this later, but right now they're emptying their own pantry in Ashland, Oregon to make sure other people have food. And our people in Louisiana are making sure that people have places to live. So like a lot of Americans, they're doing the right thing to make sure the people in their community are taken care of. I also want to thank Ashley Hunt Martirano and Brent Cease for the 10 minutes that preceded the final 2 minutes of creating that really lovely welcome. Okay, so if you haven't gone to the National Black Environmental Justice Network website, please do it after this call. Don't do it right now. If you did it ahead of time, great, but don't jump over to something right now. Stay with us on this call. One of the things you'll notice is this organization is, in my view, really the who's who of the Environmental Justice Network. You have Dr. Bullard, you have Dr. Wright, you have Jackie Patterson, you have Cecil Corbin-Mack. So it's backed by and created by incredible forces of the environmental justice world. And so we are thrilled to have Tina Johnson, the director, on our call today. I think it says a lot of who we're all so lucky to hear from today that Tina Johnson is the person that that group of people would choose to be the director of the National Black Environmental Justice Network. So Tina, thank you so much for making yourself available on a Saturday night from Oslo, Norway. There's a lot of things you could be doing on a Saturday night, but thank you for joining us. And I'm really happy to introduce all of you to my friend, Tina Johnson.
Great, thank you, Mark, for that great introduction, and hello to the CCL community. I wanna thank you for this invitation to speak with you today. And I appreciate you all spending part of your Saturday to hear me speak about the National Black Environmental Justice Network. As Mark said, it is a network that is rooted in the sort of the foundation, the beginning of what you all know as environmental justice today. With the forefathers or elders of the movement. So I'm gonna talk about the National Black Environmental Justice today. I wanna give you some history about the organization, but then I also wanna talk to you about why we relaunched, and then I wanna get into more specific issues around current events. So we will talk about COVID-19 and then, of course, systemic racism in the context of the broader issues that the U.S. is facing right now around the killing of unarmed Black people. Hopefully we'll have this conversation and it will be useful for you all. The National Black Environmental Justice Network, NBEJM, was conceived and founded in December of 1999, and it was precipitated by a call to Black leaders from diverse sectors in the United States to stop toxic terror in Black communities. NBEJN delegates came together in New Orleans to organize and mobilize Black people, and the goal was to fight environmental racism, map out a research agenda, and develop real strategies and plans to eliminate discriminatory policies and practices and toxic threats that sickened and killed Black people and continue to do so today. These polluting industries, such as toxic waste facilities, high-risk chemical plants, oil refineries, and coal-fired power plants, have turned many African-American and other poor communities into cancer alleys, Some of you might have heard of Love Canal in New York, and have turned them also into environmental sacrifice zones. So what we're experiencing right now, at this moment in history, I would call it a double whammy. So that would be COVID-19. And then, as I mentioned, the murders of unarmed Black men and women. And these two, this confluence of these two moments in our history is what catapulted NBEJN into action once again. So what we have identified as the National Black Environmental Justice Network in this moment is a call to action to lead in this frontal assault against systemic racism. Black lives matter. And this assault on Black America has created a crisis that we believe and I feel strongly about, that is fueled by racism, economic greed, and reckless disregard for basic civil and human rights. And in keeping with Principle 5 of the 17 Principles of Environmental Justice, which was adopted in 1991 at the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit, we believe that environmental justice affirms the fundamental right to political, economic, cultural, and environmental self-determination of all peoples. And since its inception, NBEJN has pursued a proactive strategy for organizing a broad-based community to meet the environmental and health threats that disproportionately affect African Americans and other people of color. And to achieve this goal, our strategy really has been rooted in and continues to be rooted in fighting for an end to racially discriminatory environmental decision-making by raising broader awareness within the Black community, and also connecting the dots between between pollution and poor health, and promoting sustainable communities by advancing clean production technologies, pollution strategies, and economic alternatives. So our mission has been and continues to be, and I say has been and continues to be because the work, although we have relaunched this summer, has continued throughout the communities that are most are on the front lines of climate change in the US and also facing the harshest realities of systemic racism. But our mission has been dedicated to improving the lives of Black people and addressing the systemic racism that harms and denies Black people equal access to environment, climate, racial and economic justice, health, equity, political power, civil rights, and human rights. And our vision is to build a world where Black people live in communities free from the vestiges of systemic racism and environmental degradation, with full access to opportunities for building a quality life for Black children and families. In short, we want what everybody else wants in the United States and throughout the world. And our theory of change is rooted in organizing strategies that encourage active participation, what you all do at CCL, by individuals and organizations across spatial locations, so urban, suburban, rural, disciplines, economic strata, and generations, with the goal of promoting a healthy, just, and sustainable future. NBEJN raises awareness of environmental justice issues among African Americans and African descent populations around the world that are impacted by environmental racism. Our work is not just rooted in the United States. We do work with communities that are impacted on the front lines across the globe on these issues, because systemic racism is not an issue that's solely isolated to the United States, and the impacts of policies are not necessarily just an experience that one community has. And we've been reached out to currently by many people from Africa, from England, who want to know how to engage and address these issues in their own communities. So when we speak of environmental justice, what we are talking about is where we live, work, worship, play, and the natural world around us, and climate. We don't just think of environmental justice as a climate issue, but it really is about the environment in its true form. When you think about where you live and where you worship and play. So what we've done is undertaken a 4-point strategy to combat environmental racism that focuses on 1, safe and healthy communities, 2, sustainable development, climate justice, and clean production, 3, civil rights and equal production laws and policies, and for international human rights protection. MBEJN stands strong on the principles of environmental justice. If you go to our website, they're listed there. You can Google it. But these principles are the guiding light for us, in the sense that help us to strengthen coalitions, alliances, and collaborations, and the commitment to fight on multiple fronts to eradicate underlying conditions that create and perpetuate the disparities and vulnerabilities. Our platforms and our action plans are built around data-driven solutions. So we really are focused on the grassroots, but we also reinforce and undergird that work with research and analysis that can really look at the problems that we're facing with an equity lens to inform the policies that address health, environmental, social, and economic justice challenges. So now I'm going to get into what we know, and this is going to be a little bit heady because I'm going to give you some numbers, but I think this is really important to understand why we do the work that we do, and why this work is so important, even so now. So what we know is that the findings are clear. Our government and many governments have not been the best at responding to natural and or human-made disasters or pandemics, and they have not treated all impacted communities the same. So contributing to glaring racial disparities, this slow response is not new. If folks remember Katrina, which is celebrated, and which is not a celebration, but commemorated its 15th anniversary just a few weeks ago. This fits into a pattern documented in the book, The Wrong Complexion for Protection, written by Dr. Robert Bullard and Dr. Beverly Wright. And what we know is that America is segregated, and that pollution is also segregated. The Black Americans in 19 states are 79% more likely than whites to live where industrial pollution poses the greatest health danger. The politics of pollution translates into more illnesses, suffering, and deaths. These findings were well documented before the coronavirus pandemic first hit our shores, but with COVID-19, what we see is that it closely maps with race, class, place, and environmental disparities. Some people might say, well, why don't people just move? The answer to that is decades of racist redlining, which has been practiced against Black people. And the results of that are showing up in urban heat islands disparities now in 2020. Historically redlined black neighborhoods are nearly 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer on average than non-redlined neighborhoods. And in some cities, the difference is about 12 to 8 degrees. Redlining is also implicated in high COVID-19 dangers in segregated Black and Brown communities. And this is really telling because Black households with incomes between $50,000 to $60,000 live in neighborhoods that are more polluted than the average neighborhood in which white households with incomes below $10,000 live. So we can see how this practice really has had an impact. And so in April, Harvard released a study that found that air pollution is linked to higher COVID-19 deaths. So persons or people living in areas with high levels of fine particulate matter or PM2.5, we learned are 15% more likely to die from the coronavirus than someone in a region with one unit less of PM2.5. So toxic living conditions and environmental racism has helped to inflate death rates among Black people before COVID-19 struck. And now we see that it's actually had an even more devastating impact. So MBEJN's sort of relaunch is an actual direct result of COVID-19 and this study, and the thinking behind, you know, what we could be doing to engage. Because what we saw, and what many of you have seen as you've been following this, is that COVID-19 has exposed the racial divide in our country. And it also has shined a national spotlight on the longstanding healthcare shortcomings, socioeconomic and racial disparities, And health disparities. So many of these things like asthma, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, obesity, kidney disease, these are all things that are related to social vulnerabilities that come as a result of poverty and not having access to healthcare facilities or transportation. This is not limited to the Black community, but unfortunately, our communities are the ones that are most impacted at a higher rate than other communities. So I'm gonna give you a few more numbers. And these are kind of interesting numbers just because it's really, again, telling how a pandemic like this can actually have this impact and why MBJN just feels so compelled to step into this space right now. And what we know is that residents living near dirty coal plants are more likely to suffer from respiratory illnesses. More than 68% of Black people live within 30 miles of a dirty coal-fired power plant, compared to 56% of whites and 39% of Latinos. The other thing that we know is that disaster recovery dollars generally follow a pattern of money following money, money following power, and money following whites. A racial equity lens calls for money following need. And so building out a voice for the most vulnerable and for us, our work within the national discourse around impacts and policy, we realize that we actually need to have a space by which we can communicate the needs that we have and also influence the policy or write the policy we need to answer the call. I think another number that's really interesting that is a Rice University and University of Pittsburgh study that you all might find interesting is that in counties that experience $10 billion of disasters, now that we see the wildfires in California, white communities gained an average of $126,000 in wealth following the recovery efforts, while Black and other communities of color lost between $10,000 and $29,000. So again, I just echo that the network's role here again is that we see these disparities and how do we begin to be a part of addressing these things. I want to move into this next part of the conversation, and it is about systemic racism. And one of the things that I think it's hard for folks to hear or accept is that racism is in America's DNA. The history of American policing is a history of racism. American policing has deep roots in legal, political, economic, and educational institutions designed to control Black people and Native Americans. The historic roots of formal police departments actually come from and can be traced back to slave patrols who were tasked with chasing down Black people who escaped from slavery in search of freedom, preventing from slave uprisings, responding to disorder rather than to crime, and keeping Black people in their place. And so what we're seeing today happen in the streets of the United States with the death of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd and others, just recently Mr. Blake in Kenosha. What we see is that we live under the ever-present statistic that Black Americans are 2.5 times more likely than whites to be killed by police. So when we say that Black Lives Matter, it's really because this number should be alarming to everyone. I want to reiterate here that environmental justice affirms the fundamental right to political, economic, cultural, and environmental self-determination of all peoples. And that what we are looking at as a network is how we can create a more equitable and just system that closes the racial divide and eradicates systemic racism. And so policies that reduce poverty and inequality promotes equal protection of workers, frontline communities, and vulnerable populations, and provides safeguards against climate-induced health threats or things that we fight for or are interested in working on and do work on currently. And then you add to all of this climate change. So as if it's not enough. What we also know is that we're already being negatively impacted as Black communities and other frontline communities by climate change in a disproportionate manner. And MBJN seeks real climate solutions that eliminate greenhouse gases and co-pollutants, but we also want to create millions of high-paying jobs for everyone. But we also realize that we need to be engaging in this conversation because economic recovery oftentimes leaves out African Americans in larger numbers than most other populations in the US. I think the most important thing that I would like to say is that, and I know, and I believe this, everyone wants these things, but we want, and it's Black Americans, and we need clean air, clean water, healthy food, safe housing, high quality jobs. We want clean energy and green and affordable transportation. We want to live in the community that makes us feel good and not one that makes us sick. What is needed and what is asked for is nothing short of what any of you want or aspire for your children, your grandchildren, future generations. So the National Black Environmental Justice Network solutions approaches are really, again, rooted in a lens of equity and justice and developing policies that dismantle systemic racism and creates equitable and just society for everyone and not just for a few. So I'm really excited to be leading the charge here and doing this work. And thank you for your time and looking forward to your questions.
Wow. Okay. Wow. So before we open the questions to things that Flannery's been monitoring the chat, first of all, the studies and data that you mentioned, would we be able to pull that from your site?
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Good.
You can pull that from the site.
I think it's so important for people to know we're not talking about an opinion here. We're talking about hard data that is inarguable. So, and words and language matter, and people use the word equity and justice a lot, but sometimes they don't distinguish between the two. Would you mind just saying, when you say equity and when you say justice, what are you expressing with each of those words?
Yeah, I think an important thing about equity is that when we are thinking about the process by which we create systems, well, just use systems, right? Because systemic racism is systems, that we are talking about the equitableness, the not equality, the equity that's built into these systems that then can be a part of how we understand how we create a just system. So equity is really about the building of an equitable process, a process that is based on what is fair. I don't know if any of you have seen these cartoons of people looking over a fence trying to see a baseball game, but there's a person who's really tall who can see, there's a person who's kind of tall and can't see that well, and then someone who's really short and can't see at all. So then they get a stack of crates to make them at the same eye length, at the same eye level, so they can all see the same thing. And so it really is, what is that process by which we are developing our policies, legislation, our systems, that everyone will be at the same eye level and seeing across that fence. And then when we get into justice, it is this just? Do we all have the access to education that's at the same level? Do we all have the access to food or healthcare or to fair policing in our communities, where if you're stopped by the police, the odds of you being shot is not 2.5 times more likely than a white person? And that then becomes how the systems are actually implemented, right? So we have the process, the theory, the structure of it, and how then do we implement them? I would say this, I had a friend say to me, I don't think, and this is about police brutality, that the laws are racist. And I would agree, if taken on their face value, the law is based in equity, but then the way the law is meted out, is it just? And when you see the disparities that we see, we know that the implementation of the law, the implementation of the system is not based on justice. So I hope that was helpful.
I think it was very helpful. I think everybody else will also. Flannery, what are you seeing in the chat that people would like Tina to address?
Sure. We have one question from Elizabeth. She's asking, are there any specific legislators or influencers that we can thank for their support of NBJN or maybe actions that they're taking that support your organization's goals? And then a sort of addendum, she's wondering if there are any conservatives perhaps that are on board or supportive of your goals?
Yeah, I can speak to, I know that Representative Pelosi is actually doing some really good work right now, engaging in environmental justice. The Biden campaign has done a very good job of integrating into this stimulus package of $2 trillion environmental justice and making sure that that is at the forefront of how things are being developed and designed. And so there, you know, there's Congresswoman Lee, I think it's Jackson Lee. And there's a slew of, I think I will say this, the Democrats do a good job. So you have Cory Booker who's come up with some great thing, Warren who have come out with some great things from the Senate, even Bernie Sanders. You have folks in the House that have done some really great things, AOC and others. The Republicans, not so much. And I think part of that really has to do with where we are right now in the moment in history in our country. You all know this better than I do because you do bipartisan work with CCL on your legislation. There's a divide, and having the conversations, even though they're sensible conversations to have, make it really challenging right now because of the political separation, which is so wide. We have a lot of work to do, I think, across the board, regardless of what your issue areas are, to fix this, because the country doesn't work when we can't find compromise and a way forward.
Thanks. We have had a couple questions about, as you know, Citizens Climate Lobby works right now is primarily working on trying to get national carbon pricing legislation. And people are curious about how might a carbon price look through a sort of an EJ framework or in the context of an EJ world? Is it possible for those two things to reconcile? Could there be a carbon price that could fit with a justice framework?
It's a very good question to ask, and it's a very complicated question to answer. Because it's not the environmental justice community, just like the rest of the world who works on climate, isn't all on the same page on how this works. Could there be a lens or a framework by which you could develop policy that takes this lens? That is the hope, right? Like that every policy that we do has an equity lens, a justice lens as a part of that work. And for many EJ communities, like if you're looking in the Gulf South, for example, where they are inundated with toxic corridors that pollute, a question for many communities is like, do we receive a benefit that actually benefits us health-wise versus just receiving a check that doesn't help us stay healthy? So there are a lot of nuances to the question depending on the community. Then you have California who has a different approach to this and are doing in a different way that the community overall seems like they're in agreement with. So I would just say that I'm not going to say that it's not possible. I would say that there's just a lot of work that needs to go into understanding the needs, not just from an economic perspective, but from a human perspective, because most people understand the economics. We all understand money for the most part, right? Like, I don't think it makes the world go round, but it somehow has a real huge influence in that area. But we rarely ever consider sort of the depth of the human cost and the human need to have that be balanced. And that becomes more of a conversation on what does this look like? And so I think ideally building a piece of legislation or legislation that actually starts from that conversation of how do we create something that's equitable and just versus how do we make something we already have equitable and just? That's a really tough starting position, because then it's like, how do we fit this to something versus how do we build something together that fits us all with some compromise in it?
Wow. Okay, well, that went way too fast. first of all, next question is, can we have you back soon, please?
Yeah, if you guys would like it, I would love it.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, I know this is like my own personal thing, but at some point I'd like to interview about you as the poet. Not just you as the activist, but you as the poet also, and to have our people hear some of that side of you also, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, that would be great.
Great. Okay, cool. Well, you are welcome to stay on in the next 10 minutes if you want. There's just a few things we have to do, but we also understand that you have a freedom to go do things. We can't like go to a bar or restaurant, you know, which we don't really have open to us right now. So, but again, Tina, thank you so much.
And thank you, Mark.
I know everybody really loved that. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And thank you, CCL community. Have a great weekend.
Yeah. Thank you. You too. Cool. Okay. So what are we asking people to do this month? I love the recommendations. The first is we're running at about 80 endorsements a month right now, which is a really nice clip because we know how much influencers affect their members of Congress. What we're asking you to do is to reach out to people who have already either endorsed the bill or have endorsed carbon fee and dividend and ask them to make an additional statement. Again, we know influencers make a huge difference in their community. We're asking you to continue to reach out to them. It might be that you ask them to write an op-ed. It might be that they record a message. You're gonna see the next thing I'll be talking about is virtual postcards in just a minute, but that we're asking you to go to people who've actually already endorsed and see if you can get an additional statement from them. So the next action has to do with virtual postcards. You know, when we were actually able to go to DC in June and November, one of the things I would always do is go to the room where they would collect all the constituent comments forms. Because what you would go in there is there were boxes and boxes and boxes of signed constituent forms that, you know, we would be delivering in person to your member of the House and your two senators. And we can't do that right now. So we have created a way for people to make virtual postcards. I hope you take advantage of that because I think it's something where we can still have the same kind of impact. And it's kind of a fun little process to do. There's a social media bonus action. And that is September 22nd is National Voter Registration Day. And you've probably noticed that a lot of the emphasis of our work this year has been on getting people to register and then vote. So we would like you to use your social media channels to encourage voting. And so if you would do that on September 22nd, that would be great. And then the last thing, I'd also like you to look at the Laser Talk, because the Laser Talk focuses on speaking about the benefits of HR 763. Anybody who's ever had any training in sales or marketing will say you sell benefits, not features. Yes, it's important for us to understand how HR 763 works, but it's effective. It's good for people. It's good for the economy. That's what's actually going to reach people. So please, if you get a chance, please practice that talk also, because we do want to be talking about the benefits. A couple things that happened since last month's call. We just hit our 600th chapter. So that's very exciting. We're now a total of 600 chapters worldwide. Canada had its 10th birthday this month. So happy birthday to Canada for 10 years of activity. Also, in Michigan, our volunteers had a meeting with Senator Stabenow, and there were 149 people in the meeting. 149. It's probably the biggest meeting we've ever had with someone. Senator Stabenow stayed on for 25 minutes. Her aide stayed on for another 25 minutes and texted our organizers to tell them how invigorated they were by the meeting. So thank you, particularly to Linda Racine and Lisa Del Buono for putting that together. Also on the secondary ask that we had for June, where there were other bills that were bipartisan, there have been 69 co-sponsors that have been added since June. So congratulations to everybody, increasing co-sponsorship and bills that we had as sub-asks. That's really great work. You can't necessarily that we were the ones that made every one of those happen, but in most of them, there were asks that we made. Also, our healthcare action team and our business climate leaders have created a plan to have 1,000 healthcare declarations and support between now and the end of the year. And there's 334 of them so far. So Healthcare Action Team, Business Climate Leaders, thank you so much for that. Next month, Alec Posner for Students for Carbon Dividends will be our guest. So we're looking forward to that. And then there's just one last thing today. So most of you have been around the organization for a while and that you know that our founder, Marshall Saunders, died in December. University of California, San Diego, just brought on a new climate scientist, and that person is going to be filled a position called the Marshall Saunders Chancellor's Endowed Chair in Global Climate Policy and Research. So one of our very generous donors went to UCSD and said he wanted to endow this chair. UCSD accepted. And so now there is a position at University of California, San Diego, which is the Marshall Saunders Chancellor's Endowed Chair in Global Climate Policy and Research. To our two donors for that, thank you so much. We're really appreciative, and I know that Pam Sanders is thrilled also. All right, thank you all so much for being here on a Saturday. I know a lot of you are gonna be listening to the recording because you're out working in your community. And all of us again, Tina, thank you so much. That was amazing, and we hope to see you back soon. All right, thank you, everybody. See you next month.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.